One of the results would be that the people like Azov would get probably even more power and even more notoriety for playing some role in this war, specifically in the defense of Mariupol. And the result would be not great.
Are you concerned about this?
I mean, there are many things that you should be concerned right now, and not. I mean, Azov is just one of the many other things that. I mean, most of Ukrainians are primarily concerned now about the shellings and bombings and rockets that may strike their homes and kill them.
Volodymyr Shenko, we want to thank you for being with us. We want to ask you to stay with us so we can do a post-show and post online at democracynow.org. Volodymyr is a Ukrainian sociologist, research associate at the Institute for East European Studies at the Free University of Berlin. Democracy Now! Has an immediate opening for a news writer-producer. Visit democracynow.org to find out more. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
This is Adam of Ethereal and E. Tune in on March 28th at 11 p.m. for Eclectic Pandemic on KBOO Portland.
Your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Two Rivers Correctional Institution will have to obey their own masking rules thanks to a federal ruling. Oregon will set aside more money for abortion care in anticipation of restrictive laws in Idaho. And in international news, young women in Afghanistan were unexpectedly barred from school on their first day back. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 23rd, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. A federal judge ruled that Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla must follow their own masking policies after prisoner Aaron Hanna pushed to bring it before the court. The Oregon Department of Corrections has policies for employees about when they have to wear masks, and the case brought against Two Rivers showed that many were not. The judge agreed that not following those rules amounted to a violation of the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which forbids cruel and unusual punishment. The Department of Corrections argued that they were doing their best, even if mask wearing was imperfect, but the judge says that they were setting the bar too low. While waiting for the order from the court, the prisoner who brought the case, Hanna, caught COVID in January of this year. The judge, however, declined to extend her ruling to all of the prisons in the state. About 60 workers at Planned Parenthood of Southwestern Oregon have ratified their first union contract, which will provide pay raises and other benefits to the healthcare workers. Eric Tegedoff has more on this landmark contract.
Caregivers at an Oregon Planned Parenthood have approved their first union contract. About 60 workers at Planned Parenthood of Southwestern Oregon are members of Service Employees International Union Local 49 and have agreed on a 3-year contract. Lindsay is a healthcare assistant at the facility who was part of the bargaining team. She says the push to unionize began during COVID, when many people ended up working from home.
It has been really frustrating, really empowering, really rewarding, really exhausting. And of course, the biggest, most joyful part was upon ratification. Many of us were in tears about it.
Workers will receive a 15% pay increase when the contract is settled and annual across-the-board raises. It also guarantees an $18 per hour minimum wage. Other benefits include paid employee insurance premium coverage and matching retirement contributions. Lindsay says this is important for workers to feel supported.
When the employees are taken care of and really supported, it gives better patient care. So I just see this as really affecting Southwestern Oregon in positive ways into the future.
Lindsay says a coworker who has been at the organization for 22 years was her inspiration to get the contract done. She says Planned Parenthood of Southwestern Oregon was the first affiliate to recognize a union. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Oregon legislature created the Oregon Reproductive Equity Fund as one of the country's most restrictive anti-abortion laws awaits the Idaho governor's signature. Recently approved House Bill 5202 provides $15 million to help patients pay for abortion services and other logistical expenses like travel and lodging. Saadam Edmo is the executive director of the social justice nonprofit Seeding Justice, which will administer the program. Edmo said, quote, "Barriers to abortion care have disproportionate impact on people already facing multiple layers of discrimination, those with low incomes, people of color, young people, immigrants, LGBTQ+ individuals, and people who live in rural communities are most impacted by these barriers," end quote. Idaho's ban will not only affect that state's residents, but also eastern Oregonians who regularly go to Boise for medical care. After passage of Texas's anti-abortion law, which the Idaho law is modeled on, neighboring states like New Mexico and Oklahoma have seen up to an 800% increase in demand for abortions. An Oregon City High School student is suing the school district because of a video shown during an assembly in early February. An 18-year-old senior, filing as Jane Doe, alleges that the school district caused her emotional distress and invaded her privacy by showing a video featuring a male student discussing abuse he carried out against a romantic partner. The male student was shown in silhouette, but his voice was not altered. Allegedly, numerous students recognized it was Jane Doe who the male student had abused. By showing the video, Jane Doe said the district purposely caused, quote, anxiety, stress, worry, and emotional distress. The complaint also alleges that students who sponsored the assembly told multiple administrators not to show the video. Oregon School District Interim Superintendent Kyle Lair said, quote, "The district is dedicated to the safe education of its students and will remain committed to providing a safe and positive educational setting." Following the last assembly, Oregon City High School students staged a walkout. Superintendent Lair offered families and students an apology. According to the school, the purpose of the February 2nd Voices Assembly was for students and staff to submit personal stories to make the community aware that students are not alone in their struggles. Another student started a petition last month calling for Oregon City High School principal Carrie Wilhelm to be fired. The petition has more than 3,000 signatures. Earlier this month, Wilhelm announced she will leave her position at the end of the year. Oregon City parents and community members spoke out against the school administration at a board meeting in mid-March, saying not enough has been done to support students. Shay Zumwalt is a parent of an Oregon City High School senior. Zumwalt said, quote, "All of our students, all of our kids that went to this assembly, that protested outside their school in solidarity, they are betrayed, they were lied to, they were looked at with crocodile tears," end quote. Jane Doe is seeking damages totaling $832,000. Senator Ted Cruz questioned Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson in her confirmation hearings, and the Pentagon creates an independent panel to review military suicides. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Senator, I have not reviewed any of those books, any of those ideas. They don't come up in my work as a judge, which I'm respectfully here to address.
On her second day of confirmation hearings, Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson responded to Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz on whether she would be comfortable with books on critical race theory being taught to young children. Criticism of Judge Jackson's decisions on cases involving child sexual assault content continued. Missouri Representative Josh Hawley and other Republican lawmakers have called Judge Jackson too lenient in such cases. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin countered Congress's lack of action on federal legislation to protect children affects court rulings.
We have created a situation because of our inattention and unwillingness to tackle an extremely controversial area in Congress and left it to the judges. And I think we have to accept some responsibility for that, Senator.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby announced Tuesday an independent panel will review suicides in the military.
One problem that we have to get after is the stigma of seeking help for mental health problems, which is still a problem in the military.
The Suicide Prevention and Response Independent Review Committee will focus on 9 bases stateside and overseas, including 3 in Alaska, where the Army has seen an alarming jump in suicides in the past year. Ukrainian forces have fought off Russian efforts to occupy Mariupol and claim to have retaken a suburb of Kyiv. State Department spokesperson Ned Price says Ukraine will continue to receive weapons and equipment assistance.
It is then up to them to use that equipment to good effect against these invading Russian forces.
The U.S. could find itself with too few COVID-19 tests if Congress fails to authorize new funds and cases surge, White House officials warned. Rapidly falling demand for tests is leading some manufacturers to cut back, with shipments of molecular tests falling more than 50% in the last month. Meanwhile, coronavirus infections are rebounding in Europe, up more than 36% in the U.K. in the past week. 2 Republican governors, Spencer Cox of Utah and Eric Holcomb of Indiana, have vetoed bills this week that would have banned young transgender athletes from participating in girls' sports. The vetoes signal a sharply different approach to the issue than the 11 fellow Republican governors who have recently signed similar measures into law. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Giving circles are offering a way for women who have been historically excluded from philanthropy to give to organizations. In giving circles, members pool their resources and award grants to nonprofits. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Philanthropy groups are pointing out the big gap in donations toward groups focused on women's and girls' issues during Women's History Month this year. According to the Women's Philanthropy Institute, less than 2% of philanthropic dollars go to these organizations. But a different model for giving could help fill the gap. Giving circles are a collective philanthropy model where people pool their resources and decide which causes to support. Tammy Wilhoit is with the Portland-based giving circle 99 Girlfriends. She says many circles bring women together because they historically have been excluded from philanthropy.
People who may not have ever seen themselves as somebody who could invest money in their community are being invited to say, hey, come help us figure out where this money should go, and your money makes a difference.
Wilhoit says her organization is inclusive of all women, including people who are gender non-binary and gender non-conforming, and trans women. She says members of the circle contribute $1,100, $1,000 of which goes into a grant pool that is awarded to a nonprofit that year. Wilhoit says 99 Girlfriends recently allocated $90,000 to Constructing Hope, an organization based in Portland that trains women, people of color, and formerly incarcerated individuals for jobs in the construction sector.
It develops a diverse workforce. It helps with long-term unemployment. It helps those people that are impacted by that to develop sustainable careers. It's reduced recidivism, and it's provided people to the construction industry, which never has enough participants.
Sarah Lamaline is head of Philanthropy Together, a group that supports giving circles worldwide. She says the circles can be flexible with their funds, and most of these groups are making impacts in their local communities.
84% of giving circles give locally, so we tend to support those small grassroots local nonprofits that are invisible to traditional philanthropy.
Lamaline says there are about 2,500 giving circles around the globe. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
According to researchers in Ohio, the challenges of the pandemic have made clear that an online program better serves beneficiaries of the WIC program and meets people where they are. Ohio is one of 9 states that has an offline system for reloading EBT benefits. Mary Sherman has a story.
New research is making the case that an online system would better serve the young families who depend on the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, known as WIC. Ohio is among just 10 states that requires WIC recipients to mail or present their EBT card at a WIC office every 4 months to reload benefits. Hope Lane Gavin with the Center for Community Solutions says Ohio had a tremendous health and human service response to the pandemic. But during that time, states with offline systems saw a significant decrease in WIC enrollment.
If you're on WIC, you're either pregnant, postpartum, and you have a toddler or a newborn. And so you have to load everybody in the car or take the bus just to get the benefit itself. And then you have to go shopping. So that is a whole ordeal, and that is reflected in our enrollment numbers.
Data shows that WIC participation was 9% lower in offline states relative to online states. Ohio was one of the first states to use EBT cards. And while that decision occurred years ago, Lane Gavin contends that the pandemic exposed that it actually runs counter to the program's intentions and goals. Lane Gavin says an online EBT program could improve infant mortality rates and maternal health. She uses Medicaid as an example, where beneficiaries are inherently eligible for WIC.
There's about 115,000 births in the state every year, and roughly 50% of those births are on Medicaid. So hypothetically, if all of those people got on the WIC program and the benefits were remote, it would make a huge difference in infant and maternal health in the state and the take-up of the program.
The American Rescue Plan Act included WIC modernization funding, so Lane Gavin says researchers are encouraging state officials to use those dollars to bring the system online.
Families are hurting, and as we face this, you know, inevitable COVID cliff, where a lot of these programs that were created because of the pandemic are, you know, starting to wind down, we know that families still need help.
The Center for Community Solutions has an online series examining ways to improve the WIC program. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the second part of the Totality of Circumstances episode that aired yesterday at 5:30. Hosts Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker continue their interview with Teresa Rayford. Find the first half of the interview on our website, kboo.fm. Then, of course, stick around at 6, we'll hear The Underground, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 39. Tomorrow's weather will see a mix of sun with those clouds and a high of 65. Today in history, in 2010, the Affordable Care Act became law in the U.S. By 2016, the law halved the number of people who were uninsured, covering between 20 and 24 million Americans. The quote of the day is from the book The Obama Syndrome, Surrender at Home, War Abroad, written by Tariq Ali and Terry Reynolds. They wrote, quote, "It's hard to talk about a middle ground for something that is a fundamental right." The school year in Afghanistan was set to begin today after a six-month closure, but Taliban officials announced last night that girls would be banned from secondary schools. This goes against previous promises, including Afghanistan's education ministry earlier this week urging all students to come to school. Many teachers and students did not know of this change of policy until the first day of school was about to begin. A teacher in Kabul said, quote, "Lots of excited girls were already waiting outside. They were happy and excited." Women have been banned from education beyond middle school in most of the country since the Taliban returned to power in mid-August 2021. Samira Hamidi, an Amnesty International campaigner in Afghanistan, told The Guardian, quote, "This is a worst nightmare come true for the women and girls of Afghanistan who have had their future and all they had hoped and worked for ripped away from them over the last year." Officials and residents in Rapid City, South Dakota, are having a strong reaction after a hotel owner called for a ban on Native American guests. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Officials and residents in Rapid City, South Dakota, are having a strong reaction after a hotel owner called for a ban on Native American guests. Connie Urey made the statements in a Facebook post and email following a weekend shooting at the Grand Gateway Hotel. Nick Urey is Connie's son and the hotel manager. He declined to do a recorded interview with South Dakota Public Broadcasting, but sent an emailed statement. Nick says he's against Connie's statements and the hotel will continue to accept Native American guests. He also says he's receiving threats. The community is still outraged. Red Elk Zephyr is searching for a new job after quitting his bartending gig at the hotel lounge. He says bar staff and some hotel workers have quit.
So I just didn't want to be associated with that. I didn't even think about the money or anything involved in it. I can't have that in my life.
Workers are not the only ones speaking out. Tribes, the Rapid City government, law enforcement, and other business organizations have asked the hotel owners to publicly apologize and make amends. The Native organization Indian Collective announced Tuesday it will file a federal civil rights class action lawsuit against the Grand Gateway Hotel for what it calls its racist and discriminatory treatment of Native people. In a statement, Indian Collective President and CEO Nick Tilson said, "Rapid City is our home, our land, and our community. We will not tolerate racist policies and practices like those demonstrated at the Grand Gateway Hotel." Indian Collective and two other Native groups are planning to march and rally to the federal courthouse Wednesday afternoon. A federal appeals court has revived part of a lawsuit claiming the federal government has not provided basic education for the Havasupai tribe in Arizona. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, parents accuse the Bureau of Indian Education of providing substandard services for the tribe's children.
The lawsuit against the BIE was filed in 2017 by parents of children attending Havasupai Elementary. Most of the claims have since been resolved, but following last week's ruling by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, one claim focused on basic education, like science and physical education, will now go back to the U.S. District Court. The lawsuit accuses the BIE of failing to ensure the school has staff to teach many basic subjects, and that students aren't given adequate instruction time or materials to meet the standards of their grade. Attorneys also say the COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated the problems, with little in-person instruction and many students lacking access to online learning. The Ninth Circuit Court last week also ruled that two plaintiffs who'd been dismissed from the lawsuit can seek compensatory education from the BIE for services that should have been provided. The Havasupai tribe lives deep in the Grand Canyon, and its reservation can only be accessed by helicopter or an 8-mile hike. The school is the tribe's only option for elementary-aged children to receive an education. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The National Congress of American Indians is developing a sovereignty institute to enhance and support tribal governance. It will include NCAI's Policy Research Center and a new initiative on leadership development. The institute will also work on civic engagement, which includes focus on voting, census, and retiring mascots. The executive committee announced plans for the institute Tuesday after a recent retreat in Arizona. The U.S. Senate passed a resolution Tuesday honoring the achievements and contributions of Native women. It recognizes the heritage and culture of American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian women in the United States. It praises Native women, military service members, veterans, business owners, those in medicine, artists, and a long list of other professions. The resolution is in celebration of National Women's History Month. It was led by leaders of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Kids born in 2020 may live through many more heat waves than their grandparents did. A new online tool helps people envision how climate change will impact future generations. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A recent study supports what many young climate activists have been telling elected leaders for years.
Climate change will shape the lives of young people today, and in a very drastic fashion.
Carl Schleusner is with Climate Analytics, a nonprofit research institute. His team looked at the projected frequency and intensity of extreme weather events over the next several decades. They analyzed heat waves, hurricanes, wildfires, and droughts.
And then we compared how climate change is materializing in the lifetime of different people alive today, in 2022.
The researchers found, for example, that even if current climate policy pledges are implemented, children born in 2020 may experience about 7 times more heat waves in their lives than their grandparents did. The team created a website called My Climate Future, where anyone can enter their birth year or the birth year of their kids and grandkids and see what their future might look like. Schleusner says he hopes it helps people understand in more concrete terms how global warming will harm younger generations and the urgency of climate action. Like Climate Connections? Subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Long lines are back at Russian groceries, fueled by worries about the war, inflation, and economic sanctions. Store shelves are cleared of a variety of items, including sugar, buckwheat, tampons, and insulin. Muscovite Viktor Nazarov told The Guardian while waiting in a market line, quote, "It's sad and it's funny. It feels like a month ago was fine and now we're talking about the 1990s again, buying products because we're afraid they'll disappear." The Russian economy is facing hard times with the devaluation of the ruble, currently worth about a penny, and an inflation rate that could hit 20%. Also, thousands of Russians have lost their jobs due to the economic slowdown and as large foreign companies like IKEA and McDonald's have temporarily closed their Russian stores. Local factories and other employers have begun halting production, and Moscow's Sheremetyevo, the country's largest airport, announced it will furlough a fifth of its staff. Elena Rybakova is the deputy chief economist for the Institute of International Finance. She believes that the Russian government will likely continue to close off from the world economy. Rybakova said, quote, "I'm not seeing it as a temporary shock and then we're going to go back to the liberal democracy and reintegration into the world, unless there is a change in government." KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is on the side of spring.
It's the fourth day of spring, the 28th day of horror in Ukraine. News says the Russians kidnapped over 2,000 children as the bombing of cities, including hospitals, continues, like the blocking of food and aid supplies, a waiting game, a dying game, diseases to follow the bloodshed. And what of the Russian economy, the Russian people? How many dead soldiers? How many imprisoned protesters? To be against the Russian military doesn't mean being for the American military. I am against all war. As the world's population keeps growing and resources continue to constrict, bullying becomes more rampant, whether on a person-to-person or a national scale, instilling fear and frustration. Despite war and a full range of tragedies, local and worldwide, spring comes. More than a diversion, more than hope, recharging our batteries, giving strength to the nurturing side of our beings, to dissolve the festering darkness that leads to war, hate, rape, and other evils. Whose side are you on, war or spring? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 23rd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, Nadia Romlagan, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio, hosted by Margaret Prescott. At 9, it's With Good Reason. At 10, it's American Standoff, hosted by Jacqueline Keeler. Then at 11, it's Jonesy, featuring a special encore broadcast of an interview with Max Nemtsov, the Russian translator of Gravity's Rainbow. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show about the ongoing interaction of police and communities in Portland. My name is Sam, and this show is also produced by Jasmine, who we'll hear from in a minute. For this month's show, we spoke with Teresa Rayford, longtime Portland activist and founder of Don't Shoot Portland, and a former candidate for Multnomah County Sheriff, and most recently, Portland Mayor in 2020. We checked in about some of Don't Shoot Portland's ongoing legal and educational efforts, including the ongoing lawsuit that brought to light racist training materials used by the Portland Police Bureau's crowd control team, and multiple restraining orders that attempted to rein in police use of chemical weapons during the 2020 protests. Don't Shoot is also involved in a number of initiatives to reclaim black history and culture in Portland, including rehabilitation of historic buildings in Albina, and a project called Liberated Archives that uses archival materials to document the experience of people of color at the hands of the state, media, and white majority in Portland and across the country. Teresa also spoke about her growth as an activist and how the movement for black lives in Portland has changed over time, and how she and other community members are exploring ways to address a rise in gun violence without relying on the police. This whole interview is about 50 minutes long, and we're airing it in two chunks. The first part was last night, and the second part is right now. You can find the whole thing on the